This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 13th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 151. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the big deal feature, Mario Canseco from Research Co. returns to the Breaker.News podcast to talk sports. With the NFL season kicking off and the NBA and NHL getting closer to crowning new champions, Mario found out that the pandemic is curbing buying behavior of sports fans in North America. And I talked to Cash Heed, the former Solicitor General of British Columbia, about the summer of Black Lives Matter and Defund the Police protests. The retired cop has a lot to say about what needs to change. I'll also award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those making a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is it beginning to look a lot like a provincial election this fall in British Columbia? As the Breaker.News has reported, the NDP is eyeing October 17th or October 24th for a snap election, a year ahead of schedule. Elections BC is hiring staff and negotiating office leases. This is what Premier John Horgan said on September 9th about the confidence and supply agreement with the Green Party that has kept the NDP minority in power since July 2017.
The Green Caucus today is not the Green Caucus of 3 years ago. You will also know that the vast majority of the elements of CASA have been realized. And you will also know that nowhere in that document will you see the word pandemic. So the world we live in today is not the world of 2017. And I know that British Columbians want me to focus on 2020 and beyond rather than looking backward to a relationship I had with the then leader of the Green Party and his colleagues.
The BC Green Party announces its new leader on September 14th. As you heard on the September 6th edition of the Breaker.News podcast, all three contestants want to continue with the agreement, and they do not want an election this fall. Cam Brewer.
There's certainly no need for an early election, and I would advise the Premier against doing that.
Kim Darwin.
I had the opportunity to continue under the confidence and supply agreement for another year and a bit. I would do so. It is a better form of government than having majority governments, which I would say if the BC NDP do call a snap election, their only reason for doing so is to have a majority government.
Sonia, first now.
And if he says, well, we want out of CASA, we aren't sitting in the legislature right now, right? Bring the legislature back. Mm-hmm. Test the confidence.
But what about the former leader of the Green Party who signed that agreement with John Horgan in 2017? Andrew Weaver says that Horgan has a good reason to go to voters this fall.
I could understand why they'd want an election, and because they are looking for a new mandate to come out of a post-COVID world, and that new mandate would require government to spin on a dime and not have to, you know, worry about being held hostage in some sense by a small minority of other MLAs. That could be their argument. So I could see them doing it. You know, it's the reason why we created CASA was to get us to a stable government. I mean, for me, stability was very important. And that's one of the reasons why, I mean, I don't even know if there have been minority governments that have lasted as long and have worked as well as ours has for such a long time here in BC. So I think the Premier's done a super job. I think that CASA has served British Columbia well, and if the Premier decides to call an election, that's his prerogative.
And another thing, the last time an NDP Premier called a snap election, it didn't go so well. Dave Barrett was BC's first NDP Premier in 1972, but in the fall of 1975, when inflation was the big story, he took a gamble and lost. The Social Credit Party returned to power, and the NDP didn't get back to government until 1991. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Japan Times, Japan Sumo Association says 19 wrestlers have tested positive for COVID-19. 18 wrestlers from the Tamanoi stable had tested positive for the novel coronavirus, resulting in the entire stable sitting out the Autumn Grand Sumo Tournament starting this weekend. One wrestler from the Tamanoi stable had already tested positive. The JSA added that 12 of those infected had been hospitalized, but with only mild symptoms. The organization plans to let some 2,500 fans attend each day during the upcoming two-week tournament at the venue, which has a capacity of 11,000. In ABC News Australia, superyacht skipper fined for lying to get coronavirus border exemption for family of Mark Simmons. Greg Numa, 64, has pleaded guilty and been fined $4,500. The Lady Pamela, owned by Victorian millionaire Mark Simmons, left Melbourne on August 9th for a 15-day voyage with seven people on board. A day after the group docked at Gold Coast City Marina, the exemption was revoked and all seven were ordered into hotel quarantine, which ended on Tuesday. The court heard that Lady Pamela stopped at three locations along the New South Wales coast, a coronavirus hotspot, where Numa, Mr. Simmons, his wife, and others were seen leaving the yacht. And in Apple Daily, don't hold 2022 Winter Olympics in China, say rights groups. A coalition of more than 160 human rights groups has urged the International Olympic Committee to revoke its decision for China to host the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing, citing a litany of allegations about abuses committed by Chinese authorities. Uyghur, Tibetan, Hong Kong, and Mongolian rights groups based on all continents are among the letter's signatories. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. Ginny Burgle of Stateline. State watchdogs plan to monitor COVID-19 data accuracy. A bipartisan coalition of fiscal watchdogs have banded together to try to help make sure states are compiling and tracking information the same way. In many states, COVID-19 data presented to the public has been conflicting and confusing. So far, auditors from the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and 11 states, from Hawaii to Louisiana, have joined the effort. In Washington state, officials have blamed an overwhelmed disease reporting system, software issues, and changes in methodology for creating hurdles to providing timely, accurate data, including the coronavirus positivity rate. Kay Rambo in the Oregonian. Rumors about Antifa wildfires in Oregon are false, law enforcement says. Some mainstream conservative pundits and a major police trade publication, as well as conspiracy theorists aligned with QAnon, have all promoted the false narrative about the historically destructive and deadly wildfires. While investigators are looking into arson as the possible cause of at least one fire, authorities say there is no evidence to suggest the arson is politically motivated. In Czech news, Victoria City Council votes to allow homeless sheltering in Centennial Square. It's a shocking move for some following weeks of crime and violence in Centennial Square, including a drug trafficking investigation. Businesses already struggling to survive the pandemic are frustrated with City Hall's yo-yoing. Homeless advocates say banning sheltering downtown isn't going to change much. Those living on the streets will find ways to be near their resources. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Black Lives Matter and Defund the Police. Those were the rallying cries at protests across North America this summer, big and small, peaceful and violent, sparked by the May murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis and stoked by the U.S. presidential election. Politicians are taking a close eye at police budgets, some for ideological reasons, some for budget reasons at a time of economic crisis. It has also sparked counter-protests in support of police, recognizing that the rule of law is essential to a livable community. My guest on this edition is Cash Heed, the former Solicitor General of British Columbia. Before that, he was the Deputy Chief of the Vancouver Police and the first South Asian Police Chief in Canada when he led the West Vancouver Police Department. What do you think needs to be done to modernize policing while keeping the peace and enforcing the rule of law?
Let me tell you right at the outset, I have been calling for police reforms for over 20 years now. It's my job with the Vancouver Police Department as the inspector, superintendent, and then the chief of West Van. We've got police leaders that are still operating in a paradigm that is decades and decades old, but we have difficulty moving them. If you recall, Bob, we talked about community policing that particular area. We talked about intel-led policing for years, but really many of the police agencies that we have operating in North America and here in Canada, with reference to Canada, is operating from a paradigm of the early 60s that went to 70s and 80s, where we militarized police, and that's the way we police our communities. We really haven't gotten away from that. So when you look at what is occurring now, when you look at the excessive use of force that's being videotaped by people with cell phones, when you look at what occur after the fact, when we find out later on that the police tactics were as such, you really have to question this public institution, whether they're actually delivering what they were intended to be. If you go back to Peel's principles, you know, the police were healers of conflict. We've kind of moved from that, Bob. We've moved to this paramilitary, if not a militarized, a way that we're policing our communities. And that was never meant to be the role of a police officer. So when we look at these excessive use of force, when we look at the calls for police reforms, when we look at the community going out there and calling for it, when we look at the demonstrations, more so in the United States, but we've had them here in Canada, you can see there is a grassroots movement to change policing. However, Bob, what I've really noticed over the last few months is we're getting a real pushback, not only from police leaders, we're getting a pushback from politicians. They don't want to change. You know, again, unless we keep this rallying up for these police reforms, we are not going to see much change. When you talk about divesting in police, I like to use the term divesting rather than defunding police. Yes, we should look at how we budget police agencies, what they do with the money we give them. In British Columbia alone, in a year, we spend minimum $1.6 billion on policing. Bob, we have never looked, we have never audited, we've never had the Auditor General, even the Municipal Auditor General, when they were in place, look at how that money's been utilized. And at the end of the day, Bob, whether it made a difference, whether it created safer communities, whether it dealt with the perception of fear, just look at the communities, for example, Surrey, which hopefully we get a minute to talk about, but look at the perception of fear based on some of the activity that's going on in that area. Police are not, Bob, and I spent 31 years doing this, police are not doing a very effective and accountable and efficient police duties in our communities.
You referenced Surrey, British Columbia, the second largest city in British Columbia, and forecast to eventually overtake Vancouver and be the biggest city. It's moving towards a municipal police force. The BC NDP government has approved a plan for Surrey to switch from an RCMP contract to its own municipal police force. It hasn't been without controversy. There is a pushback in Surrey, people that don't want the RCMP to go. There's also people that really just want their say. They're not satisfied with the way the last election went. They would like a referendum because this is a very large expenditure and they don't exactly know what they're going to get. There's some fear that they'll get a bigger bill for police, but fewer boots on the ground. What
Bob,
do you think needs to be done?
So much. It's fear-mongering. It's fear-mongering by people who don't want the change, people that are objecting to the policy change. We had a politician, the mayor ran basically on two significant issues. That was the SkyTrain and independent municipal police. He said right from the beginning, this is what he was going to do. And whether you like him or you dislike him, you've got to respect him for delivering on his promises. And that's rare in the political world that we're in right now. And I spent 4 years in that world. And I'll tell you, very, very seldom do politicians deliver what they promise to deliver during the election. So you've got to give the mayor credit. Again, whether you like him or you do not, he's delivering what he said he was going to be delivered. There's not going to be a referendum. People are still objecting to this policy change. And you're going to have that right into the whole policy implementation and policy outcomes. People are going to be objecting to it. We've got this political chaotic environment in Surrey right now, and that's not changing. When you talk to people in Surrey, all they want, Bob, is a effective, efficient, and local accountable police agency operating in that. The RCMP, I'd say to you, let's keep them in Surrey and let's keep them in other communities if they were delivering on those three key streams, effectiveness, accountability, and efficiency. But they're not. And they're controlled outside of Surrey municipality. They're controlled outside of British Columbia, seen as a sister general. I'm very well of that. They report to Ottawa. And that's where we have to bring this local accountability back. We have to deliver local police services to the communities in Surrey. And I think this is the only way they're going to accomplish it, by having their own independent municipal police agency. Now, Bob, you've heard me for years talk about a different police model that I think is more efficient, effective, and accountable to all of Metro Vancouver, and that's a regional-style unified police service. And I'm still an advocate of that, and I think we eventually will get to that. But the movement to Surrey to form their own municipal police agency, in my opinion, is a very, very good move. I think it'll deliver on the three key streams that we're looking at for that community. I think in the long run, there will be economies of scale, especially when you're starting out as a new agency. You can look at look for those economies right now. There's no need for police agencies, for example, to have their completely separate financial division, HR section, a multitude of other administrative tasks that are already duplicated within the city. Work with the city. Work with the city resources. Work with other stakeholders out there to make a difference in that community. So Surrey has a real opportunity, and they need to capitalize on that opportunity.
Right now, we're seeing crime trends, especially in big cities and inner cities, sometimes connected to some of the protests that have gone violent, and often not connected at all. But we're seeing a trend, at least through the media, of more thefts, break-ins, vandalism, violence, shootings, and assaults. And some of these are connected to the addiction problems that and homeless problems that major cities like Vancouver have. Where do you think this is going?
Government is focused on something else, and they should be right now, all three levels of government. And that's a pandemic we're going through right now. And you can understand that. So when you look at some of the financial resources, they're directed to dealing with the pandemic that's affecting the majority of the people within their communities. And I think that's where they should be. So when you look at what is going on, we're starting to focus again on the addiction part of it here in British Columbia. But when you look at what is going on and the need for those resources to be there, the need for the attention to be in those particular areas, you can understand why some things will fall off. And I think that is part of the reason why we're starting to see that increase in property crime, some in violent crime, and of course, public disorder issues that especially Vancouver is facing, and Victoria to a certain extent, if not some of the other communities. But I think it's the era we're in right now, complicated by the pandemic, complicated by the issues that are taking place in the United States. I think we're focused a lot on the presidential race down there, the bizarre atmosphere, the bizarre claims made by so many down there that are running for office. And I think we're kind of sidetracked. And I think that has a lot to do with why we're starting to see this uptake in crime and disorder here in Canada. Remember, the United States has done some has had good programs around policing. Matter of fact, the CompStat program, which Bill Bratton brought into New York when Giuliani was mayor, I'm an advocate of that. Matter of fact, I brought that particular program into Vancouver after meeting with Bratton and his people in Los Angeles. And so I'm for something proactive in that nature. Again, we learned from the United States. I think what we've done is we've kind of gone with our own unique culture around policing, and we've adapted to what is going on in the United States. And I think that's problematic. But there are some good things that we can learn from some of our American counterparts.
Finally, we'll shift into politics. There's, of course, the United States presidential election, which is getting all the attention, but there could be some elections that Canadians and British Columbians weren't bargaining for this year. Will Justin Trudeau's federal Liberal government or John Horgan's BC NDP government seek a new mandate? Will they go to voters, one or the other or both? Yes or no, thumbs up or thumbs down?
Let's just talk about federally first. I don't think Trudeau will go to an election this fall. I doubt if he'll go next spring. I think you'll see the Liberals call for an election next fall, and you may see a new leader there. You know, Christine Freeland certainly has some high profile roles there. She seems to be a qualified individual. She's well liked by the electorate in Canada, the people that I talk to at least. And Justin Trudeau has a few issues that have come up in the past few years. And one is this wee scandal that is still hanging around him. So I think that may be a bit of an issue. So I think with the Conservatives, yes, they've got their leadership in place. Whether they're able to bring on some of the constituents to favor their party remains to be seen. I know social conservative concerns have been raised by a lot of people that I know that previously supported the Conservative Party. So I think the Liberals, if they went with someone like Christine Freeland, I think they'll be governing for another 4 years if an election's called next year, next fall. Provincially, I'd be doubtful whether Horgan would call. I'd be surprised, I should say, if Horgan called an election this fall. I think there's just too much going on right now with this pandemic. I think there'll be a bit of a backlash because people are more concerned about, you know, whether their kids are able to attend school. People are concerned whether they'll be able to, you know, socialize a bit more. We've got, I think today was a record a number of people that tested positive for COVID-19. We don't have a vaccination in place. We don't have rapid testing in place at this particular time. And people are just focused about trying to make their ends meet right now. Many people are suffering economically. And again, a lot have been affected by the death or the illness of family members. So I'd be doubtful and I'd be surprised if he went and called an election, Horgan called an election this fall. I think there'd be a bit of a backlash. But he does have the popularity of the voters right now. But I think that popularity will remain with him through the spring of next year.
That was Cash Heid, the former Solicitor General of British Columbia, and the former Deputy Chief of the Vancouver Police and former Chief of the West Vancouver Police. The wide world of sports was turned upside down by the coronavirus pandemic. 6 months ago, after the World Health Organization declared the emergency, the NBA was first to put its season on hold. Others followed. One by one, sports channels reached into their vaults to broadcast some of the greatest games of days gone by. The Tokyo Olympics were postponed to 2021. But first Major League Soccer, then the NBA, and then the NHL and Major League Baseball returned in time for summer, but without fans in the stands. The Vancouver Canucks entertained in the Edmonton bubble, and the Toronto Raptors did theirs in Florida, both going 7 games in their series before losing. How has the pandemic changed fanatics? My next guest is Mario Canseco, a pollster with Research Co. in Vancouver. He went to find out. On September 11th, he released a poll headlined "Pandemic Curbs Buying Behavior of Sports Fans in North America." I asked him what the main takeaways were.
Well, I think the main one is the fact that we don't see a lot of people in North America, both in Canada and in the United States, spending as much money on sports as they used to. We see a big decline when it comes to the number of Americans and Canadians who are going to a pub to watch sports. You know, it used to be 23% in the U.S., 18% in Canada in 2019. It's dropped to 12% in the U.S. and 8% in Canada. So more than a 50% reduction in the number of people who go to the pub with all of that economic activity that it feeds. Also, not a lot of people who are buying sports apparel. It went from 23% in the U.S. to 15%, and in Canada it went from 16% to 7%. So not a lot of jerseys to be sold. It's been difficult for all of the franchises to try to establish that connection. And the other one is subscriptions to cable or satellite channels. And we had 20% of Americans who said that they subscribe to a channel in order to watch sports. That's down to 10%. And in Canada, it went from 15% to 7%. Now, some of these games might be something that you can watch without a specific sports network that you need to subscribe to. But in any case, it's definitely a reduction from the way in which people felt about these sports just a year ago.
What is the major difference between the respondents from Canada versus the respondents from the USA?
Well, I think one of the main ones is we do see that those in the United States tend to spend more on everything. They also tend to wager more. They're more likely to say that they're fans of the leagues. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the leagues are based in the United States. We have more than half of those in the U.S. who say that they are fans of Major League Baseball, 59% who say they are fans of the NFL. The only thing that gets close to that level in Canada is the NHL, which is a national pastime, at 54%, but the numbers are lower. The NBA climbing a little bit, at 37% in Canada, partly because of the Raptors doing so well in the last NBA season, but the numbers are just not there for any of the other leagues, whereas even the lowest-ranked league in the United States, which is Major League Soccer, is at 26%, which is 5% higher than what we see in Canada. So, you know, it's definitely an issue where the U.S. considers the sports and the leagues somewhat of a national treasure. We only feel that way about the NHL.
I also asked Mario Canseco, what is driving the downturn trend? Is it economics? Are fans avoiding stores and bars for fear of the virus? Or is it because sports fans found new things to occupy their time during the pandemic shutdown?
Well, I think it's a combination of the three. You know, one of the things that we've been tracking in Canada is how much people are going out to restaurants or to pubs, and the numbers are definitely not where they used to be before. So even if you're not going to the pub or the restaurant to watch a game, the numbers really haven't climbed to the same level that we had back in 2019 after the lockdowns were over. There's also, of course, the economic aspect. You know, maybe you don't want to spend a lot of money on the new jersey that your team has actually put out or anything that is related to the team. We could argue that people are saving money because they're not going to the games as they used to. And this is definitely problematic for some of the leagues, but not for others. You know, we saw it in Europe when the French or the Dutch soccer leagues essentially said, we're going to shut the shop because most of the money is coming from people who actually attend the games, buy tickets, and are in the stands. The leagues in Spain or England or Italy that get a ton of money from the rights to actually broadcast the games can continue online, can continue without anything else because they are going to get that revenue from somewhere. The only league in North America that is affected as deeply as some of the minor leagues in Europe soccer would be the CFL. And I think that is one of the reasons for them to have decided that they can't carry on unless they can have people attending the games. You know, even though we have seen fewer people going to the games, particularly in the larger cities, that is a big chunk of the revenue for the leagues and for the teams themselves. You can't continue a league like the CFL in the same virtual way that that we see the NFL carrying on or that we saw Major League Baseball pursue. So I think it's a combination of factors. But I think what this shows is that sports fans are going to have to establish a new relationship with their teams. You know, are you going to follow them online more often? Are you going to be buying some of those packages to get back some of those subscriptions and all the channels that you were watching? Because, you know, there doesn't seem to be a situation that would suggest that we're heading into, for the sake of argument, a Super Bowl that will be played in front of 80,000 people. It just doesn't look feasible right now.
That was Mario Canseco, president of Research Co. in Vancouver. Go to researchco.ca to see the full survey results. When your peace is gone, you won't stand alone. We'll all stand together, because this is our home. And it don't matter what color you are, because love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
Parkinson Society British Columbia, which is holding its annual Superwalk fundraiser this weekend, virtually because of the pandemic. Parkinson's disease is a degenerative disorder that affects movement. You can help find a cure and you can help those living with the disease. Go to parkinson.bc.ca. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. We're all in this together. And we've got to brave the stormy weather. You can count on us, we're your neighbor. And we're all in this together. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 13th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on September 13th in 1989, Archbishop Desmond Tutu and other religious leaders led a multi-faith, multi-racial march in Cape Town, South Africa? More than 30,000 people turned out to the pivotal protest that helped end apartheid. It happened a week after F.W. de Klerk's National Party won re-election. De Klerk eventually legalized the African National Congress and freed Nelson Mandela. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.